In her new book, Harvard historian Jill Lepore takes on nothing less than American thinking on, life and death. There's a chapter on breastfeeding. It was once considered beneath sophisticated white women, so black women did it for them. Now, Jill writes, there are designer briefcases for breast pumps, a country that looks like a giant human dairy farm. We also read how a man named Paul Popenoe went from racial purity and eugenics to launching the marriage counseling movement. Karen Quinlan, whose case sparked the right to die debate, makes an appearance, as do lawmakers like Richard Nixon. He signed legislation legalizing contraceptives and ruled that doctors on military bases could perform abortions before advisors told him to reverse that thinking to win Catholic voters. It's a huge history, and Jill Lepore joins us just to touch on it. But Jill, first, why this book? What questions were you asking?
I think I'm at that stage of life where one kind of agonizes over the stages of life. You know, I sort of look in my own household and I feel like I have people of every decade of life living under my roof with me. I assume that most people have been plagued by the same questions. There's very little original about the questions that keep me up at night. How did other people deal with these? How have our ideas about birth and life and death and the meaning of life changed? And it seemed to me there were some pretty epic changes going on even in my own lifetime that are mostly unspoken in a kind of cultural way. They really paralyze our politics, but we don't, I don't know, have really meaningful conversations about them.
Well, and you say you presume that people always had the same questions. Well, maybe they didn't, is what we find out. Because, for instance, this idea of old age as an illness is not the way we used to think.
Yeah, or a lot of people know adolescence is a stage of life that is largely a kind of historically specific invention. That's maybe more commonplace knowledge. The sort of newer and trendier stages of life, like tweenhood. In living memory, there weren't tweens.
Well, and as you said, there were hardly teens. Who invented this idea of adolescence?
G. Stanley Hall, who was this guy who taught at Clark University in Worcester, who was a leading psychologist of his day, was a rival of William James's.
And he decided what?
Hall was much influenced by Freud, but he was much influenced by sort of quackier 19th century thinkers like Sylvester Graham, whose only living legacy is the Graham cracker. Graham was swept up in the Second Great Awakening, the religious revival of the 19th century, and believed that what was corrupting America was masturbation. And he decided that a dietary change could stifle sexual desire, and that this dietary change involved vegetarianism, but it involved Grahamism, which was a specific set of eating practices to do with Graham flour and especially these crackers. And G. Stanley Hall sort of grew up with Grahamism and with the idea that the anxiety of the transition from childhood to adulthood was about the inappropriateness of expressing oneself sexually. And Hall kind of attached Grahamism to Freudianism and came up with this theory of adolescence that hugely influenced psychology and generated essentially the whole industry of the treatment of adolescence in some ways as a disease, which is like old age, it is treated as a very pernicious stage of life.
But sometimes these people that you introduce us to, sometimes they foist thinking on the American public, sometimes they seem to follow it. For instance, Paul Popenoe seemed to want to foist this idea of eugenics, racial purity on the American people. When that didn't work, he switched to marriage counseling. but then others seem to be following American thinking. I mean, you write about an America that in 1800 had a fertility rate that was 7 births per woman. The average age was 16. The life expectancy was 40. By 2010, fertility had way fallen to barely 2 children per woman. The average age was 37, the life expectancy 80. But the whole birth control movement was almost catching up with Americans who were already practicing it.
We like technological explanations. We want to think that something changes because some new machine makes it change. People always think, oh, yeah, well, the sexual revolution was caused by the pill in 1960. Just simply not true. Or that the declining birth rate in the 19th century was caused by some new contraceptive technology. Also not true. Social change and cultural change are far more powerful forces in this history. And yet our cultural conversations haven't really kept up with those changes. So someone like Popenoe is fascinating. I mean, just really kind of as a person who embodies a whole set of shifting ideas. And like most young men of his generation, he's swept up in Darwinianism because the theory of evolution kind of has made its way to the United States, where Darwin is hugely popular as just a matter of reading.
And what years are we talking about here with Popenoe?
Popenoe is born at the end of the 19th century. And it's at that point in the United States when there's a think about the massive waves of immigrants coming to the United States at the end of the 19th century. There's a great deal of conversation among elite scientists who are interested in heredity actually as a way of thinking about the American population, who begin to perceive it as a crisis that the birth rate has fallen so dramatically, largely among white native-born stock.
Not among poor immigrants.
It's poor immigrants who are having larger families. They begin, they're commissioned, a lot of these guys are kind of commissioned to study whether you could breed people the way the kind of work of breeding has been done with livestock. Popenoe is wrapped up in that, coming from an agricultural family, and then comes to think that is sort of swept up in this wave of conservative political ideology that wants to restrict immigration and wants to avoid what Teddy Roosevelt calls race suicide, that native-born Americans are kind of eliminating themselves from the population. So Popenoe becomes this really important leader of the eugenics movement, the American eugenics movement, which is quite powerful. California is one of the first states to pass a eugenics law, providing for forced sterilization of people who are deemed unfit, largely people who are in insane asylums or people who are considered feeble-minded. This whole piece of American history is completely tied up with the birth of the intelligence test, which also comes out of that same group of people who are involved in the eugenics movement who want to quantify intelligence so that they can decide who can and cannot reproduce.
Right, and you introduce us to one of the women who's an early experiment. She is sterilized, and reporters meet her decades later, and wow, she seems just fine and actually quite bright and okay and everything. How'd that happen?
The eugenics practices that were widespread in the United States in the 1920s have been recently the subject of a lot of agitation. North Carolina recently issued a public apology because the eugenics board in North Carolina, I think, existed until 1972. What's interesting about someone like Popenoe, who's this guy who's utterly involved in the sterilization movement, he goes and he writes a series of books, Sterilization for Human Betterment, and he conducts an accounting, and he then becomes convinced that the problem isn't so much unfit people breeding, but fit people not breeding enough. And so his principal then cause is the problem of women getting an education, going to college and having a career and not having enough, so that wealthy, white, native-born women are not having enough children. Then he turns to marriage counseling, and it's just the inverse of sterilization. You could keep fit people from not getting divorced by giving them counseling in a marriage clinic. Then this would be as good as sterilizing the unfit.
And he launches the Can This Marriage Be Saved column for the Ladies' Home Journal. Other tangled history includes Paul Popenoe support for Margaret Sanger's work. Now, poor immigrant women were begging her to create a better birth control. They didn't want to have 20 children. Popenoe thinks, what a great idea. He doesn't want poor immigrants to have more children either. It's fascinating, the intersections. Jill Lepore's new book, The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death. When we come back, why we're so efficient here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Harvard professor Jill Lepore. Her new book, The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death, traces the history of American thinking on just about everything. Stories of real-life people like Milton Bradley, inventor of the board game Life, which Jill uses to illustrate stages of life. Before the break, we heard about Paul Popenoe, founder of the eugenics movement, who then became, the head of the marriage counseling movement. There was also in the 1900s Frederick Winslow Taylor. He becomes the father of scientific management, a school of thought that includes a future Supreme Court Justice, Louis Brandeis. And Frank and Lillian Gilbreth, they have 12 children. They're the subject of the book Cheaper by the Dozen. But Jill, they were also efficiency experts. And it turns out they may have based all of their thinking, which we live by now, on a fraud, Frederick Taylor.
All these guys are bound up in this moment in the progressive era when there's this enormous confidence that we could solve every human problem with the application of science. Taylor takes that and applies it to work, how we work in a factory system. So let's say you have a company where you are building cannons for the army. He would go in and observe how the molds are built, how the metal is poured into the molds, how it is moved from one part of the shop to another, would conduct what were called time motion studies to see how long every act takes and how many motions it takes to undertake these different movements that are part of the manufacturing process. Then he would write a report saying, here's how you could do your work much faster, more efficiently. A lot of what Taylorism offers does sort of work. Productivity is sped up on assembly lines, and you know, Henry Ford's assembly line is bound up in this. But actually, Taylor, the actual guy, who was instrumental in the founding of the Harvard Business School and who lectured at the Harvard Business School every year during the years it was open.
Because once business was made a science, you could have a school.
And so home economics follows the same model, right? Yeah. That all parts of living, business, the home, could be scientific. And that's how we lead our lives itself, each stage of life. But Taylor, you know, it was revealed during his own lifetime, and not least among inquiries conducted by the House, he largely would just actually guess about stuff.
Well, and not only that, he treated the workers, if he thought of the workers that he was talking about, as animals, you know, and they might be hurrying up their work in some time, but they were dropping dead. There wasn't a connection to the human element that he had his stopwatch on.
Right. It's making men into machines. And he also felt, and a lot of placement services, what kind of work people should actually be allowed to do, could be determined by racial categories and also by intelligence testing. So a lot of this kind of the sort of the rising psychology movement in the first decades of the 20th century is also associated with these notions that we just sort of sort people out, treat them like machines, and they will do the work that is required.
And yet, what did you mention the Harvard Business School? What else came from this thinking? Not just Taylor, but Lillian Gilbreth. What else came from their work?
Gilbreth is one of my all-time favorite characters. Did you read She Provided the
Dozen? I did, and I saw the movie.
Yeah, and saw the movie. You know, and I love Myrna Loy, and I remember thinking that movie was so bizarre. But I loved the book. I loved the kind of the whimsy and the chaos of that family life. And then comes to pass, of course, the book is written by the children decades later. And when you study the actual life of Lillian, like it's completely lost on you if you've read the book or seen the movie, that she earned a PhD and wrote, you know, 15 books during those same years.
On efficiency.
Raising those 12 children, but she worked with her husband. They're really responsible for what we think of now as ergonomics. They wanted to actually not treat humans like animals, but to understand what was human about the nature of the work. Could we improve efficiency by making workers chairs so they could sit more comfortably while they work, so that they could do more work? They were very interested also in making tools that would be available for the handicapped. So after World War I, when a lot of soldiers came home with missing limbs, the Gilbreths were involved in thinking about tools that could make it possible for people to get through their lives. But then Lillian Gilbreth was widowed at a very young age, and she had these 12 kids, and she determined to get them all to college, and there really wasn't any family money. And when she tried to go get contracts to do the kind of work that she and her husband had been doing all along for large firms, people just laughed at her. They found out finally that she was a woman. They didn't know. She published under the name L.M. Gilbreth for a long time. And so she became a leader in the science of housewifery.
Even though, as her children said, wow, she never once gave a bath, made a meal.
She didn't know how to cook. My favorite thing about Lillian Gilbreth is her kids say, you know, the only thing she could make when the cook who lived in the house was away was, they called it DVOT, dog's vomit on toast.
Which is, say what it was. It was like a beef thing. It was like
chipped beef. It just sounds revolting, really,
right.
Doesn't it?
And yet she, much the way the other people that you introduce us to, stumbled maybe into really impacting our lives. And you can draw a direct line from her to O Magazine, you know, in this idea.
Yeah, or like if you have a triangle in your kitchen, or like if you think about your work triangle at work, that all comes from Gilbreth. She built this thing called the Kitchen Efficient. And that stuff really does live on with us.
Well, whether it's her or Richard Nixon, who was for birth control before he was against it, and for abortions, and I don't mean for abortions, but for the ability to have an abortion before he was against it so that he could win over Catholic voters, or Popenoe, who was for eugenics and race purity before he switched to marriage counseling. What we're also hearing is that Americans at different times were for something before they were against it, and things that were modern in science now seem hilarious to us, and you can't help but think, oh, we're going to seem hilarious.
We are absolutely going to
seem hilarious.
There's
no way we can.
You can't escape your own time. I think the comfort to be found, though, is think about how much of our politics is really affected by the very high-pitched rhetoric of life and death, the kind of politics of abortion, the right to die stuff.
The so-called death panels that don't exist.
There's a lot of murderous rhetoric in our politics, and the highly hyper-partisan discussion over abortion, which really, if there's a single, or gun rights, like if you sort of take these two things, those two issues, there's no more divisive issues in American politics today. And it's because the rhetoric of life and death is evoked. And it's always invoked as if there are these kind of timeless truths, you know, we are right, you are wrong, we are good, you are evil. Okay, so we are really stuck right now politically over some of these really deeply troubling issues. They are going to change, though, because there's nothing but change. The only thing that is continuous is change.
Jill Lepore, the new book is The Mansion of Happiness. By the way, that's a phrase taken from another board game, right, in England, earlier in England. A History of Life and Death. You can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Jill, quite something. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
So what do you think? We swear by now, but people will think hilarious 50 years from now. The debate over gay marriage, reality TV. Let us know, hereandnow.org. Latest news is next, Here and Now.